Bingo.
Light bulb.
And we're rolling. Okay. You know that feeling once the like sound volume, you must know this from your days at the radio station. It's like we're live.
Which I'm actually, my radio show is coming back on the air. It's a really long story, but I did this radio interview with KABU Community Radio up in Portland in October when I was at Powell's doing a reading and a book event. And the DJ, we did, it was like Between the Covers. I don't know if you listen to that podcast. David Nyman usually does
Sometimes I do.
that. So Ken Jones was the interviewer. But anyway, we did it at the KABU studios. And then Ken and I just became friends. And he was like, let's bring the Naughty Edge back on the air. And so I'm actually doing a show on Thursday in Portland. It's not going to be pirated, obviously, but legit radio on Thursday. So I'm really excited.
Wow. That's exciting to hear that that's like still a part of your life and wasn't just kind of a moment in the narrative of the book, like still doing radio.
Well, it's going to be a very different experience because I'm definitely going to have to censor what I say and what I play. FCC regulations this time around. And the equipment will be upgraded and it won't be in a trailer in the woods. So it'll be a different experience, but I'm still looking forward to it. It'll be fun.
That's exciting. Where are you now? Where are you reaching me from?
I am on campus at my campus job. I'm in my campus office. And we're actually moving, they're remodeling the building we're in. So I'm actually here trying to label all my stuff because they're about to move.
I was gonna say it looks like the shelves are a little empty for a writer.
Yeah, very, none of my books are here. Actually, I've moved around so many departments on campus. Like, I think this is my sixth move, I think, since I've been teaching here. And so all of my books are still over in English, the English department. So I never moved them over because now I'm in communication. And so I never moved them over to communication. So they're just in boxes in English. And I keep asking the chair over in English, I was like, should I come get my books? And they're like, it's fine. So,
I
yeah,
know.
anyway, the story.
It's funny how much books can become just a source of anxiety or even a nuisance. Like I was cleaning the house today and dusting books and trying to organize them, and pretty much the only sensation I have is, oh, should have read that. Why didn't I read that? Did I read that? I think I read that, but I don't remember reading
Yep. It's true. Yeah. So where are you? Are you in your third or second? Are you done with, you're not done with your MFA yet.
I'm done with the MFA.
Oh, you are. Okay.
I have a diploma, but I can't prove it because my mom has claimed it. But I think I have a degree, and I'm still in Tucson, Arizona, and adjuncting at the UA and doing some other kind of copywriting stuff.
Okay, nice. Are you looking for like a full-time teaching gig or?
Yeah, at some point it'd be nice. I recognize that there are a few pieces to put in place before I can really be a kind of, viable candidate on the job market. So, until then, but like a book, for instance, would be nice.
Which I'm sure, do you have something close to a book
No,
ready?
not even
No.
close.
Oh. There.
It's actually it's like, I mean, it's always a pleasure to read the book of someone you've spoken to or met, but then especially someone's debut, I'm kind of like obsessed with debuts. Like, how did it happen? How did the first time happen? I don't know. I mean, would you care to share anything of that journey?
Sure. Well, I mean, when we met, I think I was still in the journey of submitting.
Okay, back at AWP.
Where did I meet? I met you because we did that piece together. It was Nonfiction Now,
It was
right?
Nonfiction Now, that's right.
Okay, where was that? That was in Arizona.
That was in, Yeah, that was in Phoenix. Yeah.
Okay. What year was that? That wasn't last fall, was it?
No, yeah, I think it was.
2 years ago?
2 years ago.
Wow. Time is so weird.
I know.
No, it was definitely
last fall. It was last fall.
Okay. Oh, right. Okay. So it had just been accepted for publication.
Wow.
From Split Lip Press. When I was there, it had just been accepted. So, the journey to that was many years of, writing, revising, restructuring, the book a number of times. I think I completed like a version of it in 2019 and like 2017 and started sending it out. And I thought, I thought I would go the agent route. That's what everybody was telling me to do, because I had published like the Guernica essay and it got like some play, you know, like national play. And so I was like, okay, I'll try the agent route. But because, as you know, it's like very nonlinear, it's kind of anti-chronology, it doesn't follow a point A, point B memoir narrative. I kind of got rejected a lot by agents who were like, I don't know how to sell this, especially from somebody who's unknown. Like, I was kind of an unknown, you know, I'm not like a famous writer.
That's interesting that you say that, because like my first impression of the book after receiving it and seeing the gorgeous cover was the table of contents struck me as a kind of hero's journey, you know, the home, the break and the return. And I was thinking, that is like, I mean, I recognize that a lot of the pieces are nonlinear and lyrical and, but it seems like there's a pretty robust narrative arc there. I don't know.
Yeah. So I think so too. Thank you. I'm glad that you see that. And I really like when readers tell me that they do see that. Like my book club just read it and that was a really interesting experience because it's people that know me, but they commented on how there was an arc to it. But that was the major, actually the rejections I was getting from agents and then publishers, university presses, was, this is gorgeous work. We love it. We love the concept. We like your writing. But there's a lack of a narrative through line that's holding it together. And this was before I had really nailed the structure. So what happened was that I was getting these rejections and they were all the same. They were all lining up the same, which was, where's the narrative through line? So I hadn't really nailed that yet. So I hired Kari Luna, who actually blurbed the book. She's a novelist in Portland, to read it. I hired her and she was incredible because I was so in it, I couldn't see outside of the framework of the book. Mm-hmm. And I needed someone outside of my life, outside of my MFA program, like just really distanced to read it. And she gave me some really good ideas.
Oh, I think you froze.
Are you still there?
Oh, I can hear you now, but I can't. Oh, yep. Yeah. You're back. I'm back.
Okay. I don't know if that's my internet or yours. And the university's internet is wonky sometimes. Anyway, so she gave me some really good ideas on how to restructure it and then to write some new pieces to it where she felt like she didn't really know what was going on. And that filled in, I think, the narrative arc. And then she actually had me split one of the essays, all of the chapters that start with like of something, like the first one I think is of, that all used to be in one piece, in one essay. And she was like, what if you split that out into individual chapters and had them kind of sit on their own? And I loved that idea.
Wow.
And then eventually so all of those kind of through line, the narrative arc kind of came together once I did that. And then once I renamed some of the chapters so that, they were called like the narrator on distance or the narrator on, I forget what they all are, but you know, it's like referring to myself as the narrator. So once I nailed all that with her help, then when I submitted it, then Split Lip grabbed it.
Wow.
And so I think it was really just I needed some help, outside help, to see where the pieces were missing.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question about.
I mean, it makes me curious about how it felt to, you know, kind of hammer in the nails of that structure in the end. I mean, did that feel like something that was no longer true to life? I mean, I could imagine, you know, capturing the lived experience of opening up your marriage would like not readily admit to a strictly linear narrative arc.
Well, and I feel like it was always an intention in the process of writing all the book and putting all the pieces together that I knew, even after Kari read it and gave me some feedback, that I didn't want the linear narrative at all, that I wanted to go back and forth and back and forth. So that was really intentional. But I think what she helped me with was like to put things in place so that the reader could ground themselves throughout
every just enough.
Yeah, just enough that it felt like it held together as a whole.
I mean, I certainly, I felt like I was going on a journey and like I knew where I was, even if I was suddenly dropped into like, you know, a deep meditation on the flora and fauna on the farm. Or, I mean, it seemed like there were multiple types of logic at play, not just kind of linear and rational, but also there was like an intuitive and an emotional logic carrying me through. I mean, I literally read it in like 2 or 3 days. It was just a very, it was a real burner. And it, maybe this is TMI, but it kind of went off like a little bomb in my household over here. And me and my girlfriend were having all kinds of, inspired discussion around the subject.
That's wonderful. I mean, that's like really my hope is that, and that's what's been really interesting about putting it out in the world the last few months and going and having all these book conversations around the Northwest and with other people is all the different ways that it's inspired conversations about relationships, place, cultural norms and, you know, the ways we live. And so, you know, and all those aspects from like marriage to monogamy to, how we experience desire, how do we live in place? How do we become parents, motherhood. So, it's really inspired a lot of really interesting conversations. And so I'm really glad to hear that it's provocative enough for you, distance, to spark interesting conversation with your girlfriend. Was it in a negative way or just?
I mean, it was definitely in a challenging way. I think, you know, well, maybe. I guess my sense of the book at the moment anyway is that one of its jobs is to ask a question that's on everybody's mind. Oh, I think I lost you. I hope that's not my internet. I don't think it is.
Hello again.
I'm sorry about that. I don't know whose end is responsible, but
I don't either. Maybe
my internet looks like it has full bars, but you never know. Yeah,
I know. I don't know if it's mine either, but
should we pick up?
Yeah. What were we talking? We were talking about. What the conversation?
Yeah. I mean, I think I think the book asks a question that's on many people's minds in, you know, monogamous relationships, which is, you know, what do you do with desire that, you know, as far as I can tell, doesn't really abide by most, you know, conventional structures. I mean, it's a wilder thing, maybe.
Yeah.
And so what do you do with that? Mm-hmm. And what do you do with, when the structure of a monogamous relationship seems either threatened or not to be working anymore, or, you know, in repair in some respect? What does that mean for the nature of the bond that you have? And what, you know, what lasts in the face of, any disruptions to that structure? 'Cause it's kind of a weird thing, isn't it? Like, you know, sleeping with someone outside of the marriage is a violation of a kind of contract, I suppose, potentially. But I don't know, it doesn't necessarily have to threaten the bond and the relationship that's underlying that agreement. I don't know. I guess I kind of got that impression from the book in the end, that there was still some core relationship between you and Josh that was persisting through everything.
Yeah.
Even through a lot of turmoil.
Yeah. Right. I mean, there's love, right? There's love there, even though it was, and I think that's the complicated thing in long-term monogamous relationships, because it's not for a lack of love. You know, I think that, what I think is interesting is that, I mean, we live so long now, right? I mean, we live these like really, really long lives. We used to not live this long. Right? Like the average age of death. I mean, I should be probably not alive right now, you know, years ago. But so to keep up a certain type of bond or love over a long term is not an easy task. And then when you start to kind of question conventional structures, I mean, that's where I really was like, wait a minute, I didn't know that you could have different types of relationships, you know, like I got into relationships when I was really young and, you know, I was on that track of fall in love, get married, have kids, have the career. I didn't realize that like at some point something might shift. And the way that shifts in some people's relationships is they just have affairs, right? When things don't go well in their long-term relationships And so I was never introduced to this idea of like, oh, it doesn't have to be monogamous. And then it's not, and that's this inherited kind of patriarchal structure that's like all based in sort of ownership and land ownership. And, you know, so as I started to pick away these pieces, I was like, oh, I don't want to do this. Or I need to question, you know, somebody sees me in a new way. And so why is it wrong to have a relationship with that person? Mm-hmm. Can I do both? And I guess that was the question, obviously, that I was wrestling with. And I still wrestle with it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like that's kind of why I ended the book in sort of this open-ended way. And I'm glad that you said that, like, the book is kind of asks a question, because that's kind of how I think of the book is it is like a question. Like, I don't really give answers on like how to live a non-monogamous life. I ask more of the question of what does a woman do when she's confronted with new aspects of her identity that are being revealed in new ways after 20 some years of living a certain way. And you know, to me it's like it becomes this. It feels like almost, I mean, it's been really interesting to navigate the conversations around it, because I feel like I'm definitely just opening and being very vulnerable of like, here it is, here's my life, here are all the very, you know, intimate things that I'm portraying in my marriage and, you know, in these relationships. But hopefully that intimate portrayal and the personal becomes universal or a point of connection for people. Mm-hmm. And that's my real hope. And that's what I've seen is people read the book and they're like commenting on it. I mean, I don't have any, you know, like real reviews yet, but most vocal is that people are finding these places of connection, that personal experience is resonating on a universal level, which I think is what the power of memoir really is, and personal being in general. Mm-hmm. So, and I'm interested in your perspective from a male perspective, reading the female kind of portrayal of sexuality and desire. And I mean,
I love the question.
Yeah.
I think, you know, part of my answer, I mean, part of what I hear in that question is, could I see myself in like the narrator's experience? And the answer is an absolute yes. I mean, you know, in many respects, I was inspired to trace my own desire lines, for sure. And to open up some of that conversation with my current partner. And you know, one of the kind of like first, I don't know, the first I guess I'm trying to extend this like hiking metaphor, like we're going, you know, one of the first lookouts was was just gave me a feeling of like vertigo and fear. Like there's something scary about really following your desires in case they might extend beyond whatever the conventions are that you've kind of agreed to. I mean, I think where perhaps my experience didn't map onto the narrators just in gender terms was exactly what you just mentioned about power dynamics, like you know, for I guess my gender has for so long been given kind of carte blanche, and so it's, I don't know, it's like It is inspiring to hear it from a woman's perspective, I guess, in that respect. Yeah.
That makes sense.
But I don't know. I guess I feel like I'm not even sure what I can contribute like as a male to this conversation, or like what I'm called to say. I mean, I feel much more called to listen, frankly.
Yeah. Good.
Yeah.
No, that's great. I appreciate that perspective.
Yeah. Oh, listen to my dogs now. Sorry, just a moment. Jinjin, come here. Okay, come on, girl. Yeah. Did you find that writing the book? I mean, I think you might have mentioned this when we spoke, kind of provoked conversation in your household, you know, both in terms of like how much you would be revealing about personal details and and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I get that question a lot as I've been out talking about the book. And like writing about family and writing about personal relationships and like how I felt about that. I mean, Josh, who's actually now my ex, we're getting divorced, which has like been an interesting process to like navigate this book while also going through that. And it's great. It's really, it's friendly and everything's going well, but I've had to like kind of keep that story separate from the book. It's really interesting to navigate like real life and then a memoir, which to me is like highly crafted, you know, it's like very much a piece of art. And so I've crafted a persona in there, which isn't it's all based in truth and story, mm-hmm. the truth of the story. But of course, you know, as a writer, it's very much crafted. So talking about the book and then separating current situations been interesting. But anyway, that said, you know, for a long time, he didn't read any portions of the book. So I was publishing pieces of it. And he was just not, he didn't want to participate at all. He was always supportive of my writing, but he didn't want to participate in the content because of the emotional nature of it. But then he eventually read it, the full draft of it before it published this summer, and absolutely just loves it, you know, like he just thinks it's a gorgeous book, and he's very happy that I've written it. Of course, there's pieces that are hard for him. And to me, I feel like I really tried to come at, you know, obviously reflecting my own experience. And when I was writing about another person closely, like him or the radio man or my children, I was always trying to do it ethically, obviously, in a way that I felt was true and authentic to the portrayal of the situation. Mm-hmm. And tried to make it always so that it was the narrator questioning their own actions or mm-hmm. my own actions, my own thinking, my own struggle, questions, etc., and tried not to project things onto the other characters in the story. And to portray them ethically. But there's definitely places where, you know, I don't write nicely about Josh in the book, some of his outbursts. But those were all true. So.
Oh. I think we're frozen again.
Hello. Should we keep trying here? I think it must be my connection.
I think it might be. Let's try once more, and if we get booted again, then we can figure out an alternative.
Okay. I forgot what I was rambling about.
Well, you were talking about Josh's portrayal in the book, and I guess one of the things that I was wondering about was, you know, how would you approach, you know, an ethical portrayal in this case? Because I can't imagine interviewing Josh about various scenes or.
Right.
How do you navigate that?
And maybe, I don't know if ethical, is that the right term? I mean, to me, I was always writing from my experience, always. So that's how I approached it. And I didn't actually write a lot about him. And then it was Kari, the editor, who was like, I need a little bit more about Josh. Like, I need a little bit more of his reactions, paint some more scenes with him. And so all of it was just kind of based on memory and fragmentations of scenes, things that had happened. So writing the scenes around certain places where we just, you know, like I think there's a chapter where we decide to open our marriage. So, so what popped into my mind was like a moment we were driving home from the school picnic and like he had spent the entire school picnic, you know, pursuing this teacher. And so I was writing it from my vantage point, and I guess that's how I always approached it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I ever really thought very much about, I don't think it was conscious process of me really thinking about the other person mm-hmm. in the writing. It was always just from my perspective.
Can I share my favorite moment between you and Josh? I'm trying to dig it up here. I'm pretty sure one of your, I think maybe it was your son, like swallowed a penny or a dime or something.
My
like that.
Daughter.
Your
yeah.
daughter did. That's right.
Yeah.
There was just like, it was such a kind of, for me anyway, it was this kind of climax of absurdity, just like, you know, the whole human drama comes down to swallowing a, you know, swallowing a dime in a way. I don't know. It was so beautiful.
Which chapter, you know, that is?
I'm trying to find it here. It was one of those moments that I felt invited a lot of compassion towards ourselves for how difficult it is to be in relationships with other people. Like, it was just, you know, it just kind of said, we're all doing pretty good. You know?
Like, yeah. that was I think the whole point of, yeah, and I'm glad that you got that out of that, because I think, you know, it, to me, that chapter does show the real difficulties of a long-term partnership, like the stupid shit
right.
that you argue over that blows up into big things, and then it reveals all of our wounds, all of our, you know, failings, all of the ways that we struggle to communicate and participate in human connection, you know. It's like, and when you're raising children on top of that, and it just becomes this thing, like, I like that you said absurd, because really it is this absurdity. We're arguing over whether or not she pooped the fucking dime out, you know. should we take her to the doctor or not? And like, that becomes the conflict from which everything else comes from, like the where everything else falls apart, you know. And it's so that any that could be taken to any person's relationship, any marriage. It could be anything, you know, any argument instigated by, you know, you did something. I'm trying to think of another minutia thing that occurs.
Yeah.
You know, on a daily basis in our relationships that causes conflict.
No, that's totally, I think you really hit the nail on the head for me. It's like the minutia or the most kind of mundane, innocent moment can both like totally unravel a union, at least for the moment, and also expose this like tremendous tenderness. Like, all of a sudden now the parents are mobilized to do everything they can to make sure that this dime gets out of the child, and their own personal dramas are kind of set aside temporarily to deal with this tiny little problem, which maybe could have been far worse. I don't know what
right.
the health risks are exactly.
I don't know, and I still don't know if she ever pooped it out or not. I really don't know. I don't know if she's still got a dime. She must have, right? I don't think you can contain a dime inside of your digestive system for, I don't know, and be healthy. So.
Wow.
Anyway, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think those conflicts unravel and reveal things, our human failings and our beauties too, and all those things. And those were so much of just like the rupture was so much around these little things that became larger and revealed these larger problems in the relationship, or also revealed the wants, you know, driving out of the relationship. You know, I mean, I know going like, that whole conflict, God, I still can remember that conflict so well. Like, I still remember the hours. I don't know if you have experiences like that in your life where it was so heightened, and maybe because I've written about it almost like in a step-by-step process. Because I think at one point that chapter was almost like a how to have a fight. I think I like had narrated it as like a step one, step two, step three, and it almost can read that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It used to be, originally I had it in the second person point of view. It was like a you. But then the split lip editor decided that it might be better if I changed it out of the you point of view, the second POV. But it's almost like a step by step, like this is how you have a fight. And I still remember that those moments and the crucial parts of, like, because of that conflict, my desires got amplified. And so that was an important moment to write about in the book.
Yeah.
It felt like
wow.
a turning point.
That's a pretty powerful insight, I think, about, I mean, I don't know any of the psychology behind it, but the relationship between, you know, anger or resentment or some kind of conflict and desire. That's an interesting relationship. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you have experiences where you feel anger. And so maybe it's just my experience where I've felt anger and in response, take that anger and fuel it into a different type of energy, which was mm-hmm. designed at that moment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that act of transforming energy seems to me like a pretty good description of the writing process for me sometimes. And I mean, yes. I don't know if you felt like any of this autobiographical material transformed like under the pen or at the computer. I mean, you just mentioned that you have like kind of a heightened memory about this one episode. Were there other like shifts that happened as you were composing?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And it's almost people, I relate it to when people ask me whether, and I don't like this word, and maybe I don't know what you feel about this word, but people have asked me whether they think, whether the writing was cathartic, the process was cathartic. And I can't, and so I'm relating that question, whether I felt like I feel like I'm changed for sure after writing the book. Like, I feel like if I hadn't written the book, I would probably be a very different person. And I feel like the act of writing it definitely, the act of writing it definitely transformed me to take the personal experience, like intimate, detailed personal experience like that and craft it into something that hopefully is beautiful for to read. Definitely changed me in some way. I don't know. That's a really interesting question. I feel like I want to reflect on it more, like in what way? Like, I don't know if I became a more like wiser or like grew out of the process. So maybe that's catharsis. I don't know. I don't know what the definition of catharsis is. But I think, I mean, and that's, I don't know how you, as an essayist, you know, you write in general to figure out things, to question things, to move, like you said, move energy. And so I think the process of writing that book and reflecting on all these big ideas and questions definitely transformed me into a different person. But I don't know, I think for the better, but I can't identify what that would mean. Mm. Although, you know, I do notice that, I don't know, writers in general, writers who are writing and really thinking, and like essayists especially, I love nonfiction writers who are really investigating all these different ideas. I find that they're more, I don't know, I don't want to speak for all experience, but the openness that comes from in the investigation of the personal self, the exposure to is transformative, and then I feel like you become more of an empathetic human being, and there's a deeper understanding that you can elicit or grow from. Like, you have a deeper understanding, I feel like, of human nature from that writing experience.
Yeah,
I don't know. would agree.
I mean, I think the word empathy is definitely up front and center, at least for me. And certainly, I mean, I can imagine a reader of your book finding the protagonist like unlikable, you know, like having a kind of a self-righteous reaction to the book. And I think, you know, it's the promise of the book, exactly as you just put it, is to open up a pathway for empathy for that person to see the messiness of human nature, mm-hmm. that just doesn't abide by the simple black and white structures that they've been carrying around. And I certainly experienced moments of that myself. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it definitely helps the reader empathize, I think. I'm curious to know, like, who were your influences for this work? I mean, I thought of a couple that just came to mind recently. I don't know if you've read Jay Ponteri's Wedlocked.
No, I'm gonna write it down. Jay Ponteri.
Yeah.
Ponteri. Okay.
He
heard of that.
Wedlocked is the book, and the premise, I guess, from the other side of the gender fence is, uh-huh. Which maybe, you know, isn't a fence, but just a arbitrary line in the sand or something.
Right.
But he's basically writing a manuscript about his fantasies of infidelity, and his wife discovers the manuscript, and then things kind of go from there. So overlapping territory.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah.
Influences, gosh. I mean, some of the obvious ones. I mean, I was reading all the writers that were breaking, you know, structure rules, genre rules, while I was writing this. So, who was I reading at the time? Abigail Thomas, you know, Ann Carson, Leah Purpura. These were all the women writers I was reading at the time that were highly, like, either highly lyrical writers or breaking genre rules and doing weird stuff on the page and with form. And, you know, Maggie Nelson, obviously, she was someone I was reading at the time. I know I'm missing people. What I did do, I was kind of, and I write about this throughout the book, was I was looking at sort of intellectuals, women intellectuals in history who were breaking rules in terms of their own relationship. So, like, that's why Andreas Luz Salome, there's like three letters to her in the book, because she was kind of, you know, this Russian intellectual who was breaking all these rules and had lovers with like Rilke and Nietzsche and Freud and all these like heavy hitters, you know? And so I was reading her love letters with Rilke at that time. And I was looking for these like smart women from history who were living outside of conventional boundaries and also writing and being, you know, so Simone de Beauvoir, and I was reading some of her work, although her work is not really accessible. I mean, her novels are, I've read The Mandarins, but and then poetry was like Edna St. Vincent Millay. So they were all kind of like these model women who I was like reading bits and pieces of their work, but really I was looking at their life. And that was influencing the book. And I'm trying to think who else I was reading at the time. like structurally and aesthetically, it was those other writers that I was, Virginia Woolf, that I was reading a lot of, and kind of they were influencing the pieces of it. So I would say those were my influences. Joni Tevis, I was reading her at the time. Familiar with her?
No.
Yeah, she has like two books, and she's just highly lyrical writer, using interesting structures for her essays, and also writes a lot about place and in the environment. So I was reading a lot of her work too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so those were my influences.
What can you tell me a little bit about your process? Like where were you when you were composing drafts? And
yeah,
you know, was this kind of just woven into daily life, just writing wherever you could, or what was the process like?
I think it was a combo. I mean, a lot of pieces were written, a lot of them were written as standalone essays. But then once I was like, after a couple of years, I saw that there was the thread of, you know, it was kind of mirroring my life, what I was writing about. So I would get the idea. So it was a combination. I think I would get ideas and I would write them in a notebook or on my phone. I'd be like walking and I'd have an interesting idea. I'd remember a piece of dialogue, or I'd remember a scene that I would want to write. And so it was, I'm so fragmented. And so the process is really fragmented. But some of the, some of them just came from images, right? Or like there's the chapter on the farmer's wife. Mm-hmm. When someone called me the farmer's wife, I was like, oh, there's an essay I can write about identity and what it means to be, and reflect on identity from that lens of the farmer's wife. Mm-hmm. And then when kind of drafting that chapter, I was like, oh, what are some of the interesting definitions about identity that I can pull in as a way to structure the essay? And then trying to think about some other pieces. Some would just come really quickly. Yeah, like the one on Catholic school, I was thinking about the word Catholic, and I was like, oh, that could be the thing that holds together that piece. And so I wrote quickly around what it means. So the memory kind of came out of the word Catholic. And then I always am like looking, so the animal one where I look to animals and their monogamous patterns, I was curious, that came out of a question. I was like, well, what do animals do? Like if humans, are humans meant to be monogamous? So it was natural for me to look to nature for some answers to questions. And so a lot of it was written in pieces, and then eventually I had to lay it all out and put it together into a narrative. When it finally happened all together, it was kind of like this big light bulb, because I worked on it for so long and it just wasn't coming together. And then when it finally had the 46 chapters with the ofs in between, and you know, it just like, it was all of a sudden it was like, oh my gosh, I figured it out. It's done. Wow. So that's a little bit about the process.
I mean, I'm struck by you're having a moment where you realize that the writing was mirroring your life, I think you said, or in some way.
Yeah.
I mean, that, can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. So I don't know how your writing process is, and are you primarily writing nonfiction and essays?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know what your process is, but I didn't realize that as I was writing, that I would be writing about what was happening at the same time, you know, like it was mirroring what was happening in my life. And it was just natural. I mean, not that it was like journaling or diary. I mean, I know you're like the whole daily book and diary.
Right.
It's almost like that. Right. And when you're, it's like a mirror of your life. And then, it all seemed to be happening, and I was just writing about it, which is interesting because a lot of people think of memoir as like something you write
right
about the past. And so I've gotten questions like that where people have asked, well, why would you write a memoir? Like, you're 42. you know, and so people have this like sense that a memoir should be like, oh, I've written my memoirs, I'm older now, and I can remember my past.
Right.
But see, that's not really what memoir is. Mm-hmm. And so I struggled, I mean, this is kind of a tangent, but I struggled with like the memoir and essays, or what I should call it. It went through a lot of different variations. And that, when you get to your book manuscript, when you get there, I mean, that's really a struggle. I mean, I know people can just be like, oh, it's essays, but it didn't feel like essays. It didn't feel like a memoir. It felt like pieces that make a memoir, but I didn't want to call it a memoir in pieces. Someone, I was at a book event, someone was like, it's almost like a collage. And I was like, oh, that would have been cool. I should have called it a collage in essays, which kind of would have been cool. I don't know. That's kind of a tangent to the mirroring question.
I mean, I guess I too was struck by the use of memoir in the in the subtitle.
I'm plugging my computer. Sorry.
Okay. I'm on the shelf. Yeah. I mean, I guess there was certainly a felt immediacy. I mean, I think so. I don't know. One of the formative books on the essay for me is Lopate's anthology, and he says somewhere in the introduction that that it's difficult to write about some big event in your life as it's unfolding, and that you know, only with time can you get the required perspective, if not to, you know, fully appreciate exactly what was happening, but at least for the kind of emotional residue to wear away a little bit. Mm-hmm. And yet I can also conceivably make the opposite case, that like the immediacy of something as it's unfolding is pretty gripping, you know?
Yeah, right.
So is that kind of how it felt to you, like capturing things in media res?
Yeah. And each one, like, I'm trying to think of like the last chapter, which I try to figure, the On Forgiveness one. I mean, that one was kind of written in the midst of me trying to figure out what it meant to forgive in this relationship, and then relating it, you know, this whole, all these wild things that were happening at the same time that we were trying to forgive each other for hurting each other and the relationship. And so that was like, I was writing that while I was living it, but I guess, I don't know. I mean, I felt like you can still capture the immediacy. I guess you could argue, like you said, capture the immediacy of an emotion or a question the time you're living it. Maybe it's just different. If I were to write about forgiveness 20 years from now, if I think about that same time, maybe I'll write about it very differently. So that would be an interesting, actually, exercise, right?
Retracing the desire line.
Yeah, desire line in 20 years and see how I might write it differently. That's a weird idea. But yeah, it might be different with time, as Lopate says. I think you can write the emotional, if you're emotionally aware enough to be able to really capture what's happening in a moment. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean,
interesting question.
I guess one thing I found trying to write about my dad's death in January was that, like, right after the fact, my writing is maybe understandably humorless. Like I there's no room in the midst of like such intense grief to find a sense of humor. And now, you know, like 9-10 months later, a lot of the turmoil, just again, like little things, family conflict, that kind of stuff, strikes me as definitely having a humorous quality to it.
Right.
Which it's just, really, it's just, I don't know, maybe all I'm saying is like too soon to laugh about is a thing.
Right. I mean, yeah.
I don't know.
That's a good point, actually.
Yeah. And yet, I don't know. I found plenty of humorous moments in your memoir. Like,
well, that's good. Yeah. I was told in my MFA program that I lacked irony, so I've held that with me for a while. And I am not a humorous writer, but I'm glad that there were some moments of levity, I guess, in the memoir.
That's a good word for it, levity. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm sorry about your father.
Oh, thanks. No, that's. It's it's a thing.
Yes. Anyway, yeah. I do have a meeting that I have to get to.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
And I don't know if you had more questions, or I don't want to cut off our nice conversation.
I guess. Yeah. Maybe.
I email them really quick and tell them I'm going to be a little late.
Oh well. If you have to go, you have to go. Don't let me keep you. I think I'm just enjoying the conversation as such. I don't have any particular agenda.
Okay.
Is there anything you feel like you wanted to address that we didn't touch on, or something that's just really important to you that hasn't made it into the conversation?
I don't know. We talked about some good stuff. Structure and the process and the content. I don't know. I think you've asked some good questions. Is there anything else that you want to know about?
I mean, I'm curious to know the next project.
Oh, that's a good question. Me too. that's definitely I'm stressing about that. It's weird. It's a weird stress. I'm part of me feels like I've lost a little bit of my writing passion in the last like 6 months. Hmm. And I've been trying to reclaim it. I mean, I did write something really quickly and briefly this summer that was, you know, came out of me really fast. And again, it was about what was happening in my life at that time. And I wrote it really quickly, and it made itself known as like a short flash piece. And to me, it didn't need reflection, but I could write about it very differently some, you know, down the road. Mm. So my next project, I don't really have one. I'm trying to figure out. I have a lot of writing, a lot of essays, but there's no coherent thing to it yet. And actually, I just need to print out what I have. I mean, I was moving towards writing more about, doing more about nature and place and gender and aging and bodies. And that seems to be where I'm like writing around those sort of topics, bodies, place, aging, nature. But I don't really have a coherent anything yet. So, I need to work on that. Yeah, that's the answer to my question to that. I have a number of things that I'm writing. It's just whether they can all be put together into a book yet. I haven't had the light bulb moment of like, oh, this could be like a really cool long essay book, or this could be really cool essay chapbook, or I mean, I'm envisioning that the next one will be essays, you know, a book of essays, not a memoir kind of thing.
I guess I was curious to hear like if desire would figure pretty prominently still.
I don't know. I mean, it's different. I've been writing about infatuation, actually. Oh. So I started an essay on infatuation, which I guess is a different type of desire, in a way. And so I've got something I'm working on about infatuation and what that even is. And also writing about birds in that essay. I'm trying to make a connection between birds and infatuation. Really doing it very well.
That's the first time that connection's been made in my mind, so thank you for that.
What else is on my plate? Well, I've been asked to write actually an essay about desire for an anthology that's coming out from Catapult Books. Wow. It's funny. She needs, the editor needs it by the end of the year, and I'm so stuck on it. I like don't know if I just can't write about desire anymore, which is the question.
Wow.
It's really hard for me to write, and I want to produce something for her, but I'm having trouble going there right now. So, yeah. So birds and infatuation is what I'm
Awesome. Well, I look forward to seeing that one.
Yeah. Thanks so much for your time and for reading. And if you have follow-up questions, let me know. I'm happy to talk again or answer via email or anything.
Oh, thank you. You've been so generous with your time and I thoroughly enjoyed reading the book. So thank you. And thanks for all that you do.
Yeah, thanks. And good luck with your book.
Thank you.
It will happen. Have confidence.
Thanks, Melissa.
Okay, have a nice winter.
Likewise.
Okay, bye.